All right. Looks like we're good. So the first question is just to tell me about what you remember about working in the U of L Writing Center.
I started in the center in fall of 1979. I mainly started there because I needed a position. I needed a job. And funny thing is, I got three offers within that 1 week, and I took two of them. I mean, the others, one of them was working in a hospital doing intake kind of thing, mm-hmm. but it was going to be overnight.
Okay.
And that didn't appeal, but that would have been full time. And the other one was working as a clerk in a bookstore in what is now the Jefferson Mall. That bookstore's been gone for a long time. So I took those two. I took the bookstore job, and I took the one in the writing center, really just thinking of them as ways of paying my rent.
Okay.
At the time. Because I never thought about being a college professor. I mean, I had people in my family who had gone to college. Some of them had taught in college, but that just didn't seem like to me.
So you were an undergraduate possible. At the time?
I was. Okay. Well, I had just graduated.
Oh,
so
okay.
That was why I was trying to find a job.
Okay.
As an undergraduate, I paid my way through working at the Louisville Cardinal, and I was editor for a year, and then I worked at the Thinker for a year. I worked as different levels at the newspapers. But when I started at the Writing Center, that would have been the fall of 1979.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Helgeson was the director.
Okay.
At the center at that time. And Susan's someone that, as far as I know, somebody certainly knows her history and what
okay.
Where she went. But I've completely lost track of her, and I don't think she stayed in composition.
Okay.
But she completed her PhD here. And I do not remember whether she already had that when she was director when I was there, or
mm-hmm.
whether she was still working on it. And I remember that there was a camaraderie that reminded me a lot of the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
It was just this big room, the two big rooms that were not, there was no partition between them, but there were desks set up so that there was a sort of a demarcation. First part of the room was used for classroom space because the writing center was the venue for teaching basic writing, and that's
okay.
all it did. It was called the Writing Clinic at that time, and it had been in place, I think, since at least 1974.
Okay.
Because as a freshman, I had a roommate, and I know he was assigned because he'd always had trouble. He was dyslexic. He always had trouble writing. I'd known him since he was we were both 11 years old or something. And he had been assigned to go weekly to the writing clinic. And I assume it was the same, same place. It was located at that time in the basement of the humanities building. The group that were teaching there was very eclectic. There were a number of, women in their, mostly women in their 40s, many of whom had been high school teachers and wanted a part-time job. They were very similar in their interest in what was, what they were teaching. I mean, that was the thing that really struck me. And at the same time, there are some creative writers who are older,
mm-hmm.
and they maybe retired even, and they're there for kind of the same reason. And then there's all these graduate students, and then there are people like me,
mm-hmm.
who are just hired in because we met some criteria that they
mm-hmm.
had for what they needed. I started out as a tutor, which meant that I met three students at a time, I think 3 days a week, and there were classes being taught where there were 15 students, and there was a more experienced Writing Center worker directing those. And that's where the three students would come from. So they would be a small cohort. They were very successful, I think, with that, but the cost of it was prohibitive. The paying me to teach at a decent wage at that level just didn't really come out to be something they could sustain. You know, they couldn't get that from tuition, and the school didn't see saw a real purpose of trying to retain students who are not yet prepared for college. That is the way that the writing clinic worked, probably for the year before I got there, and then the first year I was there. And Dr. Comproni, who was the director of comp at that time, approached me, and some others of us, Wanda Martin, who was also kind of like I was. She had a BA. She was an experienced technical writer. She had worked for Data Courier here in Louisville, and she was looking for more part-time work that she could do. I mean, part-time being maybe 20 or 30 hours a week, but you could be there the whole time and work if you needed that. And there were two or three others like that that were not really involved in the program, and he approached most of us and asked if we would be interested in starting in the master's program.
Oh, okay.
And that he could get us, he thought he could get us a GTA ship. I don't think at that time there were any GTAs who were counting the basic writing work as one of the courses. Mm-hmm. But he thought he could work it out so that we could do that, so we would keep the keep those hours the way they were. And a number of us did take him up on that and began in the master's degree program. And the some of us really were wound up teaching what at U of L certainly would be a full-time position. I mean, we were teaching maybe five or six sections. So, combination of that and writing one and two, because once we got the GTA ship and we had gone through a semester, because again, they didn't have, the SAC still had that requirement, but no one enforced it at that time. You could teach in your second semester, mm-hmm. Even with only 12 or 15 hours, which now I think is 18.
Yeah, I think so.
And, because, I mean, that's what we're caught under, so that's what I'm figuring it is. So anyway, we were teaching 101, 102, and I don't know if Comp 1 and Comp 2 are probably have different names now. We do at our school than we did at that time.
It's 101 and 102 here. Yeah. Introduction and intermediate. Yeah.
And we had then maybe three sections of basic writing, and then we had summer classes too. So you could make a living, you know, as a graduate student. I mean, that does pretty well, and then you got your GTA stipend. And I'm just bringing all this up because it's odd for me now looking back at that, and thinking about how useful that was for me, because of how many schools I could go to and they say, well, what do you think about teaching three courses? You know, and I say, well, I've already been teaching five. You know?
Yeah.
And you know, that and what I found very useful throughout my career at the Writing Center was how much the teachers found the help of each other and the discussing of how they taught and what they wanted to try out and whether others had tried it out and what might happen, and our hearing them teach in the non-existent other classroom that was just on the other side of those desks that separated mm-hmm. us. So we could hear people teaching and we could talk to what was going on there and that kind of thing. I've never had that happen. I mean, I got this odd sense that this is what it is, you know, this is what being a college professor will be.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it's not. And when we would do things like placement exams, and we would do we had exit exams that we had multiple gradings on, not using the technique that trying to think. You had a comp director here before Bronwyn who had this technique of having people read the work that students had written, and then if you were looking to see whether that student was going to go into English 200 or, I'm sorry, second class, mm-hmm. then teachers who taught that class would be reading it, and they would say, this student could succeed.
Okay.
And the same thing about 100 or 101. They would have teachers who were familiar with those papers coming out of the, say, the 099 or whatever. I think we had English 100 was the number we used when I was here. So you would have that. That's a technique that came after I was here. We were still using primary trait scoring guides and doing a lot of training, and we would do many kind of ETS training sessions as we went through, and everybody was paid. I think we were paid by the test.
And this was all through the writing clinic?
It was all through the writing clinic. And we would bring in people if they wanted to read these papers and work with us. And they got paid too. I mean, if they were from the Comp 1, Comp 2 faculty. But we didn't get that many who were interested. We even looked at midterms that way. We were very interested in, you know, Peter Elbow's ideas, Ann Bartoff's ideas, Leo Dell, who came up with a lot of those scoring kind of things, Sandra Pearl also, and we had those people come in and talk to us. We had a debate between Maxine Hairston and her arch enemy. They had very different views on things, and she's still alive. She lives out in California now, and her daughter is also a composition person. But my memory for names is sometimes...
I remember reading either my comp theory or my feminist rhetorics class, Hairston, and there was a debate.
There was a debate, yes, and they came and they were in the basement of this library. The library had just opened, and they carried on the debate for us, and we got to ask them questions.
It was, wow.
But then we had things like that. It was, well, that's what universities do. But to a lot of us, it was like, wow, you know, we can't go to see these, you know, these rock stars. But they're, you know, they're coming to see us. Somebody was paying for it. But those are the things I remember. I think the Writing Center time was the most fundamental to me for how I learned or didn't learn to teach, and how I interact with students. And it always bothered me, still does, when I go into a school and you hear faculty, and I'm talking about a college, you hear faculty say, well, we were never taught to teach, you know. It angers me, really, because I want to say, well, then what are you doing here? What did you learn, you know? Because I really felt like we were taught to teach. Mm-hmm. And yet I didn't think that it was, you know, it's like Bronwyn was saying, it's not a waste, you know. It's not like what you think of as just lesson planning or something. It's really trying to make what you know into a form that other people can learn. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, learn from your students. You know, what do they need? You know, it's so many times when, you know, I'll go back, especially if I have a small enough class, I'll say, read this paper to me, which is something we always tried to do if we could.
Okay.
You know, I have the student hold the paper in front of them while they're reading it, and I'll say, don't say it to me, read it to me, and they'll stop, and they'll say, well, that's not what I wrote, you know. I mean, just small things like that. But you know, those are techniques that are like a psychological psychotherapy kind of thing. I mean, it's a way you get the students to react to the persona that you have. And I learned how important sort of maintaining a persona, an honest persona, is in a class. That you have to be able to interact with the students in a way, especially in a writing class. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily approach, say, teaching Chaucer at a graduate level in the same way. And I don't think people would expect me to in that way. But if it's an undergraduate writing course, then I want to get really close to the students. I want to help them figure out, you know, how can you take the requirements that are over here for this class and turn it into something that when you're finished, you'll be proud to work with it. And I have had students, I'll admit that it's a minority, but I have had students who've been able to go out and get, you know, 5-digit grants, you know, for projects that they wanted to work on. And they were able to write them in my class. Now, whether my class helped them write it, I have no idea, really.
Yeah.
I did see an improvement in most cases what they were doing, but I did give them the time and the space to do that. And they came out thinking that they had gotten something from it. And I've had students come up with projects that they could, again, like, for example, I had a pair of students. I let them work together. They were both in their 40s. So, again, non-traditional students. I was younger than they were at that time. And they were very upset about the absence of a stoplight on a major highway in their town. And I said, okay, why don't that can be your project.
Yeah.
You know, figure out, how do you get that stoplight? And they did all the work. They discovered, for example, that the state had investigated putting a stoplight there, and they had done tests about it. And they said, and they came up with this on their own. What was the weather then? And they looked at it and they found it was during rainy days, and they went to insurance records and they found that during days that were generally rainy, that the level of traffic is reduced on roads like that. So that was not a good test that they had done. And they went back to the state. I don't know if they were successful, but they went through the process.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's one of the success stories. But all those kinds of things come out of the experience that I had in the Writing Center more than any other thing that I did as a graduate student, I think.
Because you were working with writers so closely.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And because you had to, and again, in that case, it actually was a good thing that they were not writers who were, you know, labeled as being prepared for English, because they were more open, I think, to trying to figure out what they wanted to do at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can apply those same kind of ideas to students who are at the junior, senior level, who are pretty sure of what they want to do, but help them see ways that they can approach it differently. And I found that when I first started teaching 101, that it was quite an adjustment, I think, you know, because then you have students who are sure they, you know, they don't even need the course, and they are ready, and you're just a graduate student, and you're only 4 years older than I am, and you know all those things are true, but maybe they're wrong about the 4 years, but you know, it's. It was such a different thing. I didn't expect that so much. So then I had to take what I was in those classes. Now here comes the Writing Center again. Here's Wanda Martin and Hepzibah Roskelly and Kate Ronald and Susan Helgeson, Judith Killen, you know, all these people. Oh, there was Kate's sister, who's now passed away, Laura Harpring. She was probably, I guess she was in her late 50s or maybe even in her 60s at that time.
Okay.
And she was teaching in the Writing Center. She was a student of Sister Miriam Joseph. Sister Miriam Joseph was a teacher at, I think, St. Mary's College. Wrote a textbook for teaching writing in college in the 1930s and 20s. She also wrote a series of books about how Shakespeare was influenced by his grammar school, and she tracked down grammar school books that Shakespeare would likely have had and found turns of phrases and things like that.
Yeah.
And then later, see, people have done research on Shakespeare and they found like letters from Stratford, from the government offices, the equivalent of government, that where, you know, there's phraseology that's very similar to what you find in the plays. And so, and that makes it even better, you know, it makes him even better in a way. But learning from, you know, being in that situation, learning from someone who had learned from someone else is,
right.
I guess, what I'm getting at there. And and feeling that with the others who had, you know, were maybe 2 or 3 years further along than I was, maybe somewhat more older than that, but they had been working in the, they had their master's degrees and they were, you know, working on their doctorates, or they were almost finished with their master's degree, that kind of thing. And so I have these problems, and you know what? Here's what went on in my 101 class. I can imagine the teacher who doesn't have that, you know, to be able to go in there and say, "Here's what went wrong in my class, and what am I going to do next?" And then have, you know, to have people who aren't going to say to you, "Well, you just didn't do that right," you know, but are going to say, "Well, let's talk about it," yeah. You know, and sit around a table and say, "Well, you know, what about this way, or what, you know, what if you, how if you reacted like this?" And that kind of thing, you know, and I think that was really very helpful. And again, that's learning how to teach, you mm-hmm. know. And so having that setup was very useful. And it goes really well with what I think of as at least what used to be and may still be the U of L philosophy, which is kind of people becoming autonomous, people being able to control their own futures in some way. I mean, you know, giving people something they can use to go forward on their own without making it impossible for them to succeed. You know, it's a hard thing to explain, I guess. But I do remember...
people being the GTAs?
The people being able to come in and help the students succeed by working with what they already have,
right, okay.
and having a certain amount of autonomy, but yes, also the people in the Writing Center had a level of autonomy. You know, it was like we were making the decisions about how it ran. We had our own little newsletter that we came out with. We had a bound book that we gave to all the students. Here's the exercise.
Do you still have any of that?
I wish I somewhere they may be, but I'll bet you somebody does. I mean, there were still some around with. Ruth Miller, we had an old Gestetner machine, and I used to run that. It's a copying machine.
Found a newsletter at one point.
These were like spiral-bound books that that were they originally, I think they were called like a clinic journal or something mm-hmm. like that, and then there was then it changed to the Writing Center Journal, and there was a her first name was Pat, but I can't remember her last name. She was. She worked here for a long time, and she was the person who edited that for quite a while. But that was our textbook for many years. Well, 2 or 3 years.
You produced probably. Your own textbook that you used in the basic writing classes.
That's right. We had this book, and we made it on the Gestetner machine, which is, you know, it's like what communists used to use to make their pamphlets and hand them out kind of thing. It uses a silk screen technique. There's a company in Louisville that's still... services those. I looked them up recently. That autonomy was important, and you learn quite a bit from that.
So there was a director.
There was a director, and I think that was Susan was there for at least 2 years, maybe three. I know she was there all of my first year, and I know she was already there before that. But I don't know if she was director then. But at some point that would always shift and there would be an application process, but it had to be someone who was in the PhD program, I think is how they worked it out. So there would be a PhD student. There were enough people who were interested in it. There weren't so many as it was onerous to try to find someone.
Okay.
People weren't knocking at the door because it was actually, it was a real job. I mean, in that it wasn't like a, I don't want to say it that way, but you know, if you get a, you get a fellowship, then it's given to you to do your research and to produce some work as a result of it. But the directorship was, you know, you sit in this office, you deal with these problems, you answer the phone, you figure out what people have to do. And that's your job, and you can complete your classwork and other things during the same time. And they would also get, I believe they also got their, you know, tuition paid for, too, if they still were working on their PhD. But that's what, that's how they had Susan, and that's how they had Hepzibah, and that's how they had Kate and Forrest Hewlett, who the last I talked to him was about 2 years ago, and he was, I think at Sullivan. He was at Ball State for a number of years, okay. And he moved back to Louisville. But those were the directors that I remember being under that system. Maybe Wanda Martin was too.
Okay.
But I think once Ruth Miller came in, that it became to be more of like a staff director position.
Okay.
She was also in the graduate program, but I think they moved her into, well, we're going to have someone long term.
Like a full-time.
A full-time, yeah. That's right, yes. So she was a full-time.
Because I inherited that job when they changed over to this writing center. Ruth was the associate director.
That's right. Yeah. When they got a full-time director who was a faculty member, then she became the associate director.
Yep.
I talked to her a few years ago when I came here for some training at the Delphi Center. So,
okay.
So you know what that position was then.
More or less, yeah. What you're telling me is I'm so interested and amazed. I'm really fascinated about the history.
But it's, you
know, I know none of that.
So much of this, it's almost like, I don't know, you're too young. Spanky and our gang, but you probably know what I'm talking about. It's like it's like, or Peanuts, you know. It was always like, womp, 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 womp over here somewhere, but the Peanuts are making, you know, they're putting together their own play and everything, and the adults, Dennis Hall and, you know, Tom Vann and Joe Comproni, they're over here somewhere. You know they're there, but unless you really screw up, they're not going to bother you, because, you know, you're I think we had a better than average success rate with our remedial students, especially given what they were expected.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these were students who were predicted not to be able to get through their first year of college. And we were able to show some success, especially with that first model I told you about, where there was a workshop of 15 and then it was broken out into smaller meetings of three mm-hmm. students.
So that they changed it from that.
They changed it to like a regular classroom. It was still, I think it was still 15. It may have been 12, but I think it was still 15. And then those were just regular classes.
And there was no breakout.
There was no breakout, that's right. And there was no real tutoring going on at that point, but students would certainly come to talk to you about
okay.
their, you know, so you were both the instructor and the tutor.
Okay.
And there was no drop-in tutoring. There was no appointment tutoring. I don't think there was ever any official drop-in or tutoring like that, but I do recall that either it was when I was the assistant director, or maybe it was just when I was been teaching there quite a while, that they asked me to tutor a dental student from China,
okay.
Who was not taking basic writing. I think she probably came in and said she needed to take the basic writing course, and they decided that it was better just to have her work with a person directly in the evenings, because she couldn't really come in during the day anyway because of her other classes. And I was available, so I did that. But we did not do that on a regular basis. But it did serve as a place for the graduate students to find part-time employment for other companies. At that time around Louisville, there were a lot of companies that were looking for technical writers. And like Wanda Martin worked for Data Courier, which was kind of a web search type company, but there was no web to search at that time. But, you know, they did that kind of work, and they amassed indexes that were those kind of indexes where they take a word and they take the five words in the sentence on this side and the five words on that side, and then they just, every time the word appears, they run it down the center. It's called a quick index. I doubt they make them anymore, but that used to be what you would find in the library if you did, you know, like a search in the natural or social
mm-hmm.
sciences. So you could see how many times was a certain word mentioned, and you could trace the context of it, and with that you could find the index. And Data Courier did that kind of thing.
Okay.
Some of it by hand, and some of it later on, you know, most of it by computer later on. But when she was doing it, it was mostly by hand. GE would come to U of L and ask the English department for technical writers, and they would often come to the writing center and say, do you have anybody who would be interested in doing this? And it would often be a senior graduate student. Some of our instructors were not graduate students. Some of them were part-time lecturers. They had a fund for, they could hire part-time lecturers, and they were people who already had their degrees. But, you know, again, like the ones I mentioned before, they were interested in making some extra money, and they didn't want another full-time job. There was Warren C. Camp, for example, who retired from his business. He owned a business here in Louisville, and he had a degree in English, and he was interested in creative writing. And he worked there for many years. He was probably in his 60s. And, you know, he wasn't working for the money. He was working for something to do and working with the students. But they had a number of people like that, you know, that were working there. I haven't seen that in other places. I'm sure at that time maybe writing centers did depend on community
Well, some writing centers have what they call professional writing consultants. So they're not students. They're not graduate students, but it's someone, like you said, that's working there part-time or even full-time that already has their degree, and that's their full-time job.
A model then that they were following. That's one thing I never knew, and none of us that were there at the time that we were working there knew exactly where this started.
Well, Writing Center Studies was barely even getting off its feet at that point, so there might not have been a model, or maybe they're pulling it from basic writing or something
I do know that a lot of what we did came from interest in what was going on at CUNY. Mm. Which, I mean, this is an aside, but there was a language lab across the hall from where we were. I never learned to type in high school. In my high school, you didn't take typing if you were going to go to college.
Oh.
Instead, you took something else like psychology, or, you know, that was just the way it worked. But I had typed since I was like in the fourth grade, but I'd always, you know, hunt peck. And I was, you know, decent at that. But I made, you know, a good deal of mistakes. So everybody who couldn't really type on their own, they would go to Virginia Callen, who was at that time the office administrator for the English department. And she would charge them a certain amount of money to type up their dissertations or theses and make sure that they followed the right format. So she was like a Kate Turabian of U of L's English department. And I thought, you know, I don't think I can afford the kind of mistakes I make and the number of times I need to rewrite paragraphs. I don't think I can afford that. So I'm going to have to learn how to type somewhere. And I convinced myself that it was less expensive to buy a computer. So I bought a computer, and the language lab across the hall, the director of that was completing his dissertation, and his focus was on German exploration of the Louisville area before the falls of the Ohio were affected by, you know, any, like before there was any dam or anything there, mm-hmm. when it was still basically wilderness. And he was into this nascent group of computers and writing people. He just had met them at this conference.
Yeah.
And he said, I think you'd like these people. And so he put me in contact with them.
Because you bought a computer.
Because I bought a computer, yes. And I was going to do my dissertation on Plato's Dialogues at that point. And Comproni and others said, that's really good. Yeah, yeah. Nobody's done that stuff in a long time. You know, it's okay, that sounds good. So I connected up with a guy named Michael Spitzer at New York Institute of Technology, and he was the head of the Center for English, I think is the way. They didn't have departments at that time. And I knew him they had a bulletin board, you could get on there, and so I met all these people. This is before, by the way, that there was an internet, although I had an acquaintance as an undergraduate, and through that acquaintance, I was able to get the English department to allow me to teach a computer-based writing course in Dale Lally's writing center, language lab, because they had computers in the back.
Okay.
And I knew the guy who was in charge. His name was Hans Fiedler. And he heard me talking to the head of IT, and he came. He called me. He said, "I know what you're looking for. I know the guy that you, the math professor, I don't remember his name, you were talking to, has no idea what you're telling him. Come and see me." So I went to see him over in, I think it was in Strickler's, where they were located at that time, in the basement. And he introduced me to UofL's VAX computer. He gave me a modem, and he gave me an account, and he got me connected up, and he taught me how to program enough that I, because I already knew some. I had stolen some passwords when I was a freshman and had learned to program basic computers here. So I knew a little bit about programming. But he helped me put up a class, a basic writing class. It was the first, I guess, the first writing class on the VAX computer they had here. It was a writing class where students could dial in and they could upload their papers and they could leave them there and I could write back to them, and then we would meet in a classroom with computers over in the old natural science, well, it's still called that, the natural science building over here. And we ran that class for a few years. And through that, I learned how to work with bulletin board systems, so I met these people at New York Tech. I mean, because I knew how to work with the bulletin board systems, I was able to get connected to the New York Tech that I'd been introduced to. And I met a lot of people and learned more about how computers and writing work, and that's how I brought computers sort of into some of the classes in the Writing Center. But Michael Spitzer contacted me the year before I finished my dissertation and said, "Would you like a job? I've got a job in Manhattan, and it's yours if you want it." And I told him I couldn't do it at that point because I hadn't finished my dissertation. It really was a good idea that I didn't. I mean, I could have picked it up then, and, you know, I don't think that would have worked out all that well to have moved to New York and try to finish a dissertation at UofL. I think now that could be done because there's ways of doing all that distance, but there really wasn't much at that time.
You're right.
You know, and you would never convince your teachers that, you know,
that's a good idea.
Yeah, it's a good idea, and I'll come and see you kind of thing would not be the way. So I said, you know, keep me in mind. And 2 years later, I had my dissertation, and I applied for a job they had there, and I got that job, and that's how I ended up away from Louisville and in an office next door to, here it comes, Maxine Harrison.
Oh, really?
She had taken on a position at New York Institute of Technology, and okay. I met her again there. My point in bringing that up is that there are these strange kind of connections that came just as being in that center all that time, where there was so much of a synergy going on, and the people that I worked with were very interested in what I was doing with computers, and I saw it as, you know, just kind of the natural outflow of my not wanting to pay, you know, $1,400 to have someone write my dissertation for me when I could spend $1,800 and get a computer out of it, you know. And at that time, that was right now I would see that as a lot of money, but you know, at that time it was quite a bit. I mean, the car I was driving cost, I think, $3,400 new. So
did most people do that? Pay the money to get the dissertation typed up?
Most of the people in my department who were not professional typists, I think, did that.
Okay.
Yeah, and they didn't have to pay her. She was actually very reasonable, but she charged for each time she would have to type it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you had to have revisions done, so everybody really kvetched over whether, you know, should I go ahead and give this to her now, or should I make the revisions myself and then give it to her, you know, that kind of thing. And many of them would even take their own typewritten copy that they put together and cleaned up by hand, and they would give that to her, and she would transcribe that. And of course, that didn't cost as much.
Okay.
But if you had to work everything out by hand, or if you had a lot of errors, it was more of a problem.
Okay.
But, you know, it's also a justification. You know, it's like, well, I can imagine it would have cost me that much, even though it you know, the least it cost was $600, and the most I'd heard anybody else pay was $1,600. So, you know, so it, I figure that I'm judging that I'm going to be at the far end of it, so I can afford to do this. And that, you know, that made a lot of a difference in how I went forward with what I was doing, and I became the person that people would ask in the center about, you know, working with computers. And I think having learned how to do that in the center with that equipment nearby and with everything that, you know, was there that I could work with, it again made it more a part of me. And I mean, maybe that's the way with, I mean, that's the way this place seems actually to me. But so much here at U of L seemed that way to me. And when I talk to people that went to Vanderbilt and other places, they say, oh, that's the way school's like, you know. You go there, you get the teachers, they, you know, they grade your papers. And I got the sense that wasn't the experience. But I think if you talk to others who had been here at the same, that they would say similar things about it. So
that's funny, because that's kind of what my dissertation's on. I'm studying a cohort of the writing consultants, the master students, and so they work in the writing center for a year, and then they teach their second year of the program. And I'm really interested in the impact that the writing center makes, not just, of course, on their teaching, but also in, you know, how they think of themselves as a teacher and as a scholar, and what they end up doing after they finish their master's program, and how they're approaching writing in their classes.
Well, now let's get personal. This just came to mind. So I got married while I was at the writing center, and the writing center staff gave me a shower.
Oh. Two of our consultants just told us that they were dating,
and
it still happens.
And my wife, but my wife was not a, my wife was actually a client of the writing center the year before we started dating, and I wasn't at the writing. I was still an undergraduate then, but she had Hep C for her 102 teacher, and I helped her with her writing on that. And I still wasn't at the writing center at that time. I was still working on my undergraduate degree. Well, we had our daughter while we were there, and they gave us another shower. And they, you know, they were very interested in her progress, and they still ask me about her and how she's doing, you know. So, you know, that's like almost 30 years ago, you know. So it's not that many jobs that you would have where, you know, people would remember that kind of thing, or, you know. And so I think that happened because of where it was.
Yeah.
And I found the same kind of thing with the Louisville Cardinal. I mean, but it's so, you know, maybe every school is really that way and I just don't know it, but
I have some logistical questions. Okay. So you were a consultant the entire time you were a graduate student, all through your
That's
MA
right.
and your PhD.
There was one year I got a some kind of an interdisciplinary fellowship, which meant that I could not teach.
Okay.
I got a dispensation, because the fellowship was to finish my dissertation. My dissertation was about my teaching. So I said, well, you know, I can't really do one without the other, maybe just one class.
Yeah.
So they did let me keep one class, and that was a basic writing class.
Okay.
For every other year, I was working as a consultant or tutor
we were
instructors at that point, because they started calling it the Writing Center in probably 1980. You know, the idea that clinic is a, like there's a disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know that argument.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they even call things writing clinics anymore.
I don't think so.
But I think we were just called teachers or instructors at that point.
Okay.
Probably not called instructors, because that has another meaning. You know,
okay.
That's your rank and
yeah.
and all that. We weren't really doing tutoring at that time, but we were tutoring our own students on a need basis, and most of us ran our classes as workshops.
Okay.
So, So in that way, it's very much. And we were following a model that later on I found was very similar to the Iowa Writing Project model, or the Iowa Writing Workshop model. I'm sorry. Yeah, because I met someone who came from there, and we discussed what we had.
Okay. How were you trained?
We were actually thrown into it, but with people all around us who had experience. It was like you had to go do this, and they would tell us about, you know, what was expected and what we could expect. But as far as like observing, there wasn't time for that, I guess you'd say. You know, in other words, they couldn't pay you to observe. So they observed you by your being in the same room as they, because all the tutoring was going on in the same room, and they were just little carols.
Okay.
So you knew what other people were doing, and only people who had been doing that for at least a semester could teach a workshop.
Okay.
Where they had their own classroom.
Okay.
In most cases. So that really, and then there would be professional development, I guess we call it today, but there'd be days when, again, that whole sitting around the big round table and talking about, well, what do you want to do for the midterm? What do you think about this idea? How would we score this? What are the primary traits we're looking for here? You know, what are the, now we call them performance indicators. What are our outcomes that we're trying to achieve? You know, all those things are the same, but they've changed their names. We didn't use the word rubric for anything, for example. But it was a consensus kind of decision, because not only were you deciding what your students were going to have to do, but you were also dealing with how's it going to be scored and how am I going to interpret what I'm scoring, you know, all the kinds of norming and stuff. And that was part of the training too.
So all the classes were the same?
All the classes,
basic writing classes?
All the basic writing classes were the same in the way that many writing classes that follow a standard syllabus are the same.
Okay.
But the way they were taught might be different.
Right.
But the most obvious form that was used, because it worked well with 12 or 15 students, was like a workshop model, where you could maybe pair students together and have them work on projects while you're working individually with some others. And that probably came a little bit too from the fact that most of the people up for the first 3 years I was there, most of the people had gone through that structure that I had talked about before, the three on one with one tutor and the separate workshop.
Okay.
So they had that as a background, and maybe 3 or 4 years later, there were enough newer people coming in that they'd never experienced that, so that was not part of their, you know, original. That's kind of training. They really explain the tutoring as kind of training for teaching the class at a later point.
So it wasn't like top down where they told you, you need to do classes this way. You got together with all of the other instructors and you all made kind of a collective decision.
That's
about
how I remember.
Okay.
Yes. That it was, and that was the good thing. And that was why I said the thing about, kind of sidetracked myself, but Kathy, my wife, she commented a number of times later on about how the Writing Center had a way of doing, collaborating and working together and coming up with ideas that she had not seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, she had worked maybe in a few situations with, she was a graphic designer, and maybe in a few situations where they would come up with plans for projects they were working on, but in most cases it was, here's your job, and do this job this way, and she was used to that. And then when we went to other places, if they had a standard syllabus, it was completely worked out. If they didn't, there was no discussion about, you know, how your class was,
right,
unless you could make that happen with another teacher, and a lot of times they were not really interested in doing that.
Why do you think it was like that at the Writing Center?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the people.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I guess it doesn't have to be that way, but I mean, you've got someone like Wanda Martin who reads Mother Jones and is a subversive to begin with, or seems that way, and You've got people like Kate and Hepsi who come from families where they're they were well protected. There was just a sense that people know what they're doing, and so therefore, who am I to really tell you exactly what to do?
So it was a purposeful design.
Yeah, I don't think they were like neglectful because there was so much success that they had, but the leadership was more of we're working on this together, and then you've got the other thing, you've got these younger women who are in charge. But you've got these older women who are doing most of the work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that changes things. You know, because it's like, I know when I first started teaching full time, I mean, as a job, I mean, where I was actually getting paid to teach full time, not that I was, but you know, I would have classes where most of the students would be 10 years older than I was, because I was teaching at a school that had a lot of non-traditional students. And sometimes that's kind of daunting, you know, so I think if you're directing a program and you're the young person and the people you're directing have more experience than you do, then there are different ways to do it. You know, there's what I think the wrong way is, which like you're going to do it this way and the old ways are out, or there's the better way, which is, what have you learned and how can we do this? Because you've got a whole group of people who've had a lot of experience with working with students of all ages, and that's how you come to some, it helped that the classes that we were teaching were, this is bad, but these are the students who aren't going to succeed.
They were labeled.
That's right. Yeah. It's like, it helped because you knew that you could try things, and you knew if you moved the needle a little bit that you were having a success, because if those students hadn't had this work, they would not succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And so if any of them can succeed, and I think
you can
the
only
national,
get better from
that's
here.
Right. I think the national average then was 66% failing of those types of courses, and ours was a little better than that. We had more passing than that than ours, we were proud of that. I'm sure there were schools that did even better than that, but then we were higher than the average, and that's probably what helped us at that level. Again, Susan Helgeson would be the person to know more about that, because she was the one who was involved in the getting the funds together to create the system of the three tutors. I'm pretty sure she was involved in that grant or whatever it was that found that money, because I know the money ran out on it. And that it was considered to be very expensive.
Do you know how many years they did it like that?
At least two, maybe three years. It hadn't been in place very long when I came there, maybe just 1 year or maybe even just a semester that they had it. But I know I taught in that kind of program for, I think, 2 years, if I remember correctly. I mean, again, things do get a little fuzzy since 1979.
So what type of writing were the students writing?
We started out a lot, this was with the age of personal narrative. We also did a lot of very, very structured prompt writing. My students either hate or love the prompts I give them. Some come to me and say, I wish all my teachers would tell me what they want. But some people find that off-putting. They want to just start up and work. We did a lot of elaborate prompts, especially for the exams, the midterm and the final. We would give them a scenario, and there would be some little paragraph that would say, this is the outcome. What would you tell the doctor in this case, something like that. So there were specific context described. Sometimes they were letters. Sometimes they were a short memorandum. Sometimes it meant, for example, we had a case, this one came from a newspaper, where it was a woman that was working in a factory in Louisville, cut her hand on something on the factory line. It was something had gone wrong with the line. So there was a jagged piece of metal that, came down the line, and she cut her hand on it, and she had tried to get coverage from her employer, and I think the employer argued it was her fault because she wasn't paying any attention or something like that. I mean, it was obviously a good situation to to have as a prompt. And then they were supposed to write, you know, if you were this person, write a letter to explain why it is necessary or why why the your employer should pay for this this injury that is not that happened to you on the job. And those were the kinds of things, stuck on the highway and the road service passed you by, you know, write a complaint letter, you know, those kinds of assignments, which probably wouldn't use today, but, you know, and they would encourage us, for example, to write the answer ourselves and to talk to the students about how we came up with a response to it, and that's something I use today. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll try to, if I give an assignment that's a self-contained assignment like that, I'll often write the response and then talk to them, you know, about what goes through my head when I'm doing that. And, you know, with the same, you know, the caveat that I already knew what was going on here, but at least it gives them a sense of it. So those are the kinds of things that we did most of the time. We did not, I don't recall, except for one year when Forrest was the director, did we ever do things like quizzes. He liked something that actually was pretty good, sentence combining. That was Lee O'Dell, O'Hare and two or three other people, went, they were at Ohio State. The idea of, you know, that you can combine parts of sentences together to make new sentences, and these are called kernels, and you can get all sorts of kernels and put them together. We tried to run an entire entire year on that model.
Sentence combining.
And, you know, and I thought, you know, if they had just done this in fourth grade, it probably would be really good. You could get them to do it, but you get a bunch of college students in here and say, okay, you're going to take these sentences and put them together in more sentences. And, you know, that didn't work very well, but we had prompts like that. So, for example, we would give them a quiz on it or something, or we would do t-tests on, you know, how could they pick out the main words in this. But mostly we did those kinds of what would be equivalent of placement tests or exit exams. But there, again, there were some deviations from that over the years.
So when you worked with students one-on-one or three-on-one, what types of issues did they have with their writing, and what was your approach to work with them?
You know, sometimes they really thought that their problem was they didn't know the difference between nouns and verbs. And I think it didn't take me very long to decide that taking the time to try to, like, give them lessons in nouns and verbs probably wasn't going to help their writing. And that's where things like sentence combining can come in, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes they would know what they needed. You know, they would say, I have trouble when I come up with an idea of following it through. And I would read what they wrote and I would say, yes, you do. And so then, you know, there's an ease to that because they recognize it and you recognize it, and you can think about, I can ask them questions about, you know, what did they really want to do here? When did you begin to move away from this? You know, what caused you to? Well, I wasn't sure I believed what I was saying. Oh, well, then maybe your main idea needs to change. Maybe you need to throw out your main idea and just write what you know and come back, you know, with what is your main idea? See, at that time, most people weren't using computers. They were writing by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of being able to go back after you had finished something and change it, when it had to be clean when you turned it in, meant that you were going to have to redo all of what you thought of as the writing.
I've always wondered about that.
It's hard for people to, it is kind of, and you still see that in, at Morehead, you see students who've had high school teachers who were probably near my age,
mm-hmm.
Who learned teaching writing, or they did, but they learned it at a time when computers were keyboards,
mm-hmm.
and so they have no concept that they can sit down
composing
at a computer and compose. You can't imagine. Well, but I mean, you know, when I was first starting and working, I was composing at the computer from the beginning, because when I was working for the newspaper, we all composed at the typewriter.
Okay.
And so it just seemed like that's what you did with typewriters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't have anybody telling me that's not what you did, so that's what I thought
you
did. But no, other people would say, no, you know, it's for making it, it's for polishing it, it's for making it look good, it's for, you know, it's not for, you don't do the writing on the on the screen, you write on the paper, you know. And it's been a long time to get people to maybe move a little bit on that. Mm-hmm. I think you could even, 5 years ago, you could find a lot of people who say that, do not, and I still come across people, actually, who say, don't try to compose at the screen, you know, you.
Well,
you
I remember well. When I was in high school, it was kind of understood that you wouldn't compose at the screen, and I was a little bit confused with myself when I was wanting to compose on a computer writing, and I was unsure about whether or not I should be doing it that way.
Have you read anything about the IBM, but IBM sponsored some research in, and they centered it in Florida. Probably it went through Gainesville, because Gainesville had a lot of support from IBM.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Reading to Write. I mean, Writing to Read, sorry. Yeah, Writing to Read. That is, they taught students in kindergarten to write at a computer before they taught them anything about reading.
Okay.
And the idea was that they could channel what they were thinking onto the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And they could learn to do that before having really learned how, you know, spelling works, or, you know, reading text, or anything like that. And they say that the students who went through that process, while they didn't learn to read when they were learning to write, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, they gave up starting out with reading, but when they got a year later, they were beyond where the students who had.
Okay.
You know, so in other words, they caught up and they surpassed the students who had learned the other way. Now, the problem is that there's a lot of difference from reading a story on the computer and reading it on a text. And most of the computers and writing people, even those who are run by IBM, I mean, even the people who are doing research through IBM, never considered the effect of fonts on reading ability on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's research all the way back to the early 1900s that AT&T did, Bell Labs did, trying to figure out what's the best color for the yellow pages, which were not yellow at that time. You know, what affects people, that they discovered things like serifs are important, and that the density of the ink is important, and that the color in the background is important, and certain colors make it more difficult to read. But also certain colors of ink on certain colors of paper are harder to read than other combinations. They did all that kind of mm-hmm. research, and they discovered that the quality of the letters affects how quickly you can read it, and not only that, but how much you can comprehend.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you're teaching reading on a computer, then you should have a very high quality screen with very well rendered fonts and things like that, or you're not going to get as good an effect as if they were reading on a book, and you need to think about what color the background is, and the lighting, and all sorts of things. There's research, like, not in English, but
there was
in all sorts of other areas.
I just heard a study that was reported on NPR about a new font that came out that's mm-hmm. supposed to be used for studying and memorization, and it's actually the letters are missing parts of the letters, and apparently your brain adds in the pieces of the letters,
and it causes you to remember more. There's a certain level where you can go, and when I was taking psycholinguistics, John Robinson was the professor in that class, that's all we did. We read these journal articles from psychology, and they had these statistoscope experiments where they, you know, you've got your eyes in the little screen and the letters are coming by quickly and you have to identify them, that kind of thing. They found that there were certain levels where you could remove pixels,
mm-hmm.
Or at that time it was actually dots from the negative, but you could remove them and they could still read them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a certain level where their reading speed declined,
mm-hmm.
and then there was another level where it just, there was no comprehension
right.
at all. But if they had serifs, then that level was further away. So in other words, the serifs, which we were always taught were like decoration,
mm-hmm.
Are important to being able to read well. So a lot of people have trouble, for example, reading a sans serif text because it doesn't have all the clues that
mm-hmm.
you would expect on the letter,
mm-hmm.
and some of them can be very small. So there's a lot you can take away from a letter. I have a paragraph up on my door in my office, and it's got all these letters switched around and everything, you know, and I have people read it, you know, and I give it out to my students and ask them to read it, and they do, and they don't notice the errors, you know, and they may notice them after a while, but you know, they can read it without having to know what they're.
I think I've seen words like that and sentences like that. We should probably finish up. Let me see. You talked about the language center. What was it called? The language lab?
Language lab. It was for the languages that they were teaching. When I started at U of L in 74, if you were a chemistry major, you had to have 18 hours of German. There was a 15-hour foreign language requirement for every other major.
Okay.
So they had a language lab because in Kentucky, I mean, if you were from Louisville, you had it. You mm-hmm. know, most schools offered foreign language. If you were out in the state and you were in a populated area, you might have Spanish. 2 years later, you would have had Latin if mm-hmm. you were going to go to college. But they ended Latin in about 1970 in Kentucky as something the state would let local school boards pay for. So they only had Spanish and maybe French, more Spanish than French. And that meant that students coming here who had to meet that foreign language requirement, which was pretty stiff, it was almost designed so that if you had it in high school, you would still have to take more, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to pass it. They had to have some kind of tutoring center for them. But what they also had there were these magazines from Spain and Italy and France and, you know, popular magazines from mainly from Europe. I don't think they supported any Asian languages at that time.
Were there any other tutoring centers that had any interaction with the Writing Center?
There wasn't. When I was a freshman in 1974, the Black Student Union, I think is what they call themselves, they had a tutoring program. And I had a Cal Sables was the name of a lab technician in the chemistry department. He was in his 30s at that time. And I think he had his master's. He may have been working on a PhD, but he was a great researcher. He tutored for them.
Okay.
And they had tutors in math and other areas. But I don't think there was any officially supported tutoring program, because that's where they would, you know, like teachers would send you, or if you went to the arts and science dean's office and said, I need help on this subject, they would send you to the, I think it was called the Black Students Union.
It wasn't just for black students.
No,
They
tutored everyone. Okay. Yeah, they did. And they were good tutors. That building was located next door to what is now Johnny Unitas Tower. I'm sure that building's been gone for a long time. I think the education school is there now, mm. right? Yeah. So right next to the tower, so there was a Yellowstone building. And it was like a 2 or 3 story building. There were a lot of those little buildings on campus at that time.
Okay.
But that was the only tutoring. Now, I don't know, you know, it's very possible that math may have had something, but I know when I was editor of the newspaper that I had to help. So it's possible that the writing center only, the writing clinic only helped people in remedial courses then all the way through. Because I remember helping some of the junior, the first year reporters with some of their writing. You know, it was kind of a situation like when I was a freshman, I needed help in chemistry, and we had a study group. So I went to that study group, and there were two people there who were working on an English paper instead of doing their chemistry work, and I needed the chemistry work, so I sat down with them and talked to them about, you know, well, here's what you need to do here, and this is, because writing's just been something I did since I was about 5 or 6 years old. I mean, it's like reading, pick up a cereal box and read it and not realize I'm doing it, kind of thing. I call myself a compulsive reader. Some people, you know, that's good. I mean, if you want to be a writing teacher, it probably helps. But, you know, I know they didn't have anywhere else to go. I think that was how most of the tutoring at U of L up until maybe about 77 or so was handled. It was by what we would consider maybe peer groups getting together and study groups kind of
thing. Nothing formal.
Nothing formal, except, again, the Black Student Union did have tutors you could make appointments with. You could set up the tutoring. You could go in and find one, and you could set up a time to meet
with
that person.
You think that was probably for people that weren't doing well in their classes?
I think it was. They would tutor specific subjects. I think they received some pay, but I think they also were people who, you know, cared to do it. I mean,
okay.
I don't think they did it entirely for free, but I doubt that they were really paid very much for what they were doing. And I don't know how many subjects they were covering.
Someone's knocking. We're finishing up.
Okay. But that's, I was sent over to find out. So I think we're pretty much done over here. So.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's pretty much all my questions, though. Thank you. This was really interesting. It makes me want to kind of look in the U of L archives and see if there's anything I can dig up there. So
there might be some things. I'm sure somebody kept that material. But again, if you get to talk to Hepzibah Roskelly, Dottie Broaddus, she's back in Louisville too. Wanda Martin lives out in Los Angeles now, but they would know. If you would like, I mean, if you give me your card, I can contact Wanda and see if she'd like to talk to you.
Okay.
Because I do, I don't hear much from Hepsi, but if you, I know you said you had seen Kate here.
I think Bronwyn has her information.
But I can also find out about Hepsi, because I'm pretty sure she said she had come back to town.
Okay.
And there's an, Pam Miller is someone else by that, that's a different Miller. She worked here for a long time, and then she taught at JCC. She taught at JCC for many years.
Okay.
She may still be around, so she knows a lot about the center, too. Well, it's been good to talk with you.
Thank you.
I can help you.